Vedem, an introduction.
Kids adapt very easily, much more easily than adults do. Adults understand what they lost. Children are just more likely to accept the reality in front of them.
Episode 1. In 1954, William Golding published Lord of the Flies, a novel about a group of boys whose airplane crashed somewhere in the Pacific Ocean during a nuclear war. The pilots did not survive, the boys did. And in short order, they set up their own government, made their own rules. And what Golding shows us is how beastly, how awful boys could be. In other words, and he wrote this less than a decade after the Second World War, they could be as horrible as adults. The book sold not in the hundreds of thousands or millions, but in the tens of millions. And it would lead to Golding winning the Nobel Prize for Literature 3 decades later. But Lord of the Flies was fiction. And during the Second World War, we have a story of a group of boys who did run their own affairs, who did set up their own government. And even though 90% of them were about to be murdered, their faith in themselves, in morals and ethics, never wavered. And right now, we're in Czechia, about an hour's north of Prague, and I am standing in a room in the Terezín ghetto, or Terezinstadt, where these boys were imprisoned, along with tens of thousands of other Jews, men, women, and children. And from 1942 until 1944, the boys who lived in this room created their own magazine, which stands as a testament to what they saw around them and how they felt and what they believed in. That magazine is called Vedem, Czech, for In the Lead. Of the approximate 100 or so boys who were imprisoned together at various times in what they called homeroom number one, all but one of them was deported to Auschwitz-Birkenau. 13 of those children came back alive. My name is Edward Serrata, director of Centropa, and in this podcast, we're going to hear interview excerpts from 4 of those boys. Back in 1996, I interviewed Leo Lurvy in New Jersey, Sidney or Zdenek Tausig in New York, Jerzy or George Brady in Toronto, Kurt Kotoch in Prague, and I met with Chava Gintz-Pressburger in Israel. Chava was the sister of Peter Gintz, and Peter was the driving force behind Vedem. You're about to hear actors reading from the transcripts I made in 1996, as well as interviews conducted by Pavla Neuner in Prague in 2005. And we'll also hear 2 young actors reading the poetry and essays written by boys who didn't make it. Of the 5 Czech Jews I spoke with, only Kurt Kotoč remained in Prague after the war, and his interview transcripts are being read for us by Thomas Kraus, former Secretary General of Czech Jewish Communities, and whose father had been imprisoned here in Terezín too. These poems and essays are available in English in a book, We Are Children, Just the Same, which we encourage you to order. All the translations were done by Elizabeth Novak and were edited by Paul Wilson. Part 1. Storm Clouds. Let's start by putting you in the picture. You're 12 or 13 years old. It's 1939, and suddenly your country is occupied by Nazi Germany. What was it like for a Jewish child just coming of age then? Here's how Kurt Kotoch described it for us.
After the occupation of our town, Brno, these guys from Hitler Youth waited for us on our way home from school. And it was humiliating because all we could do was run away. I lost all my friends, so my circle was made up of just Jewish boys who had also lost all of their friends. I remember going to my neighbor's house to see the kid I would play with in the afternoons, and his mother yelled, "He's not home!" But I knew what that meant. He wasn't there for me, the Jewish boy.
Chava Pressburger was born Eva Ginz in Prague in 1930, and this is what she told Pavla Neuner and me about her brother, Peter Ginz, the editor of Vedem.
I remember, after the German occupation, how everything became so much more tense at home. Our parents tried to hide their anxiety from us, but we could feel it. Our mother wasn't Jewish. So we were called, in the ugliest way possible, half-breeds of the first degree, and we were thrown out of school. Peter turned 14 in February 1942, and the summons for him to go to Terezin didn't come until October. My father had to take him to the trade fairgrounds in Prague, where he put his son on the transport. A friend of our family told me later that once Peter was gone, when the train had moved away, my father collapsed on the street and howled in pain. Then he pulled himself together and came home. He would have to go through the same thing with me 2 years later.
Part 2. Deportation and arrival. The storm begins. Leo Löwy, Sidney Taussig, George Brady, Kurt Kotoch, and Peter Ginz all found themselves with tens of thousands of Jews in Terezin. Families were divided, put into separate buildings, in old military barracks, and the Jewish self-government of the ghetto tried their best to make things at least a little better for the children. Sidney Taussig described those first days.
When we got to Terezin, it was appalling. You could walk through the ghetto, which was horribly overcrowded, and you'd see old people in awful condition. You could hear them up in those large halls inside the barracks, just moaning and crying. People died, and someone came over and just covered them with a blanket. Some old people just committed suicide.
In a former schoolhouse, in one room, the room I'm standing in now, around 40 boys found themselves cut off from their families, frightened to death. And here's how Kurt Kotoch tells us what happened next.
We were assigned to the building L417. It had been the Terezin school building, and inside were the boys' homes. Those homes, as we called them, were just single classrooms, and each one of them had their own madrich, our counselor in Hebrew. Our room was called home number one. We were all around 13 years old, just coming of age. Our families had been thrown out of our homes, and we watched as our parents became powerless before us. We had to wear yellow stars on our clothes, and they hung transport numbers around our necks. Then we entered the reality of Terezin itself. And that is the state our Madrich, our teacher, Walter Eisinger, got us in.
Part 3. The Republic of Skid.
He was 29 years old. He was a talented teacher from Brno, just starting out. He was given the opportunity to test his theories, to live out his ideals about life and the world. We loved his confidence and his certainty. And he treated us exactly the same, whether you were a poor orphan or came from a family of intellectuals. He told us about Gandhi, he sang in operas, and he was in love with his fiancée, Vera. And in our room, we established the Republic of Skid. The name came from Eisinger, and it comes from the Skola imeni Dostoyevskovo, a school called after Dostoevsky for homeless kids in St. Petersburg in Russia. Of course, as soon as he told us that, we all wanted to be Skids.
On the night of December the 18th, 1942, our republic was founded. Everyone would have a job according to our abilities and our interests. Each person found their place. Each person had something to do. And we had our own anthem.
What joy is ours after the strife. In number one, we've made our bid.
Self-government has come to life. Long live the Republic of Skid.
Every person is our brother, whether a Christian or a Jew.
Proudly we are marching forward. The Republic of Skid is me and you.
They wrote, they drew, and they hoped. And their solace was in their creative activity, and this became the reality they founded for themselves into reason. It was like another world, and they really lived in this world they created. In this, they found consolation.
I am not sure who exactly came up with the idea of Vedem, but we worked on it, and on that Friday night, December 18, 1942, we had our first reading.
Imagine it. Around 40 boys, all hanging off their bunks and gathered around the table in the middle where Peter sat. And he called up each boy to read his poem, his joke or his article, and everyone would respond to it. That was the first issue. And it went on for 83 issues. There were nearly 800 pages. And the last one came out in July 1944. We even put a price on the cover, which we did as a joke. After all, there was only one handmade copy each week.
We had found an old typewriter, so the first issues were all typed. Then the typewriter broke down, and we couldn't find a ribbon. So we did everything by hand.
Peter Ginz, his mother wasn't Jewish, which means she stayed in Prague and she was sending him packages. I never understood how he got so many, and Peter was the editor of our magazine. A lot of boys didn't really want to write anything, but Peter would just bribe them with a bit of food so they would produce. He really was determined to get our magazine done. His mother was also sending him pens and ink and paper, and he was asking for books all the time. And soon, on Friday nights, other Madrichim and boys would crowd into our room to listen to the articles. These were our evenings, and I can tell you this about the ghetto. Kids adapt very easily, much more easily than adults do. Adults understand what they lost. Children are just more likely to accept the reality in front of them.
Here's one of the articles that one of the boys wrote for Vedem. And to think that a child would see this beggars belief.
Tragic moment. He died after 2 weeks of agony, and now people stood around him silently, observing his still opened eyes. It was as if the air had become heavier. There is a body lying on the bed, which somehow seems empty now. They covered him with a bedsheet, and after a moment of silence, the murmuring began. The doctor enters without speaking, fills out a form, and leaves just as silently. From outside, life's noises filter into the room. Laughter, chatting, shouting. But inside, people stare at the sheet and say nothing. Just then, the nurse approaches the bed, bends down, and drags out the man's suitcase. She opens it quickly, and everyone surrounds her. Human craving wins out over grief, and the mourners grab everything worth taking and vanish. Whatever sadness they had a minute ago, it's now gone, and the abandoned soul lies on the bed and surely cries. Unsigned, Vedum, June 1943.
Later, in 1943, this article appeared.
The world belongs to the young. The youth of today is our future. These are the slogans you could see throughout Europe. Recently, someone told me that they should be sending only the old people on the transports. He said the young would suffer more in the East, especially in a moral sense, and that would harm them in the future. Well, if we are really such egoists, to sacrifice the lives of our parents and grandparents for the sake of our moral health, something we could regain later, then there is something quite wrong with us.
In other words, they didn't know what it meant to be sent to the East. And while they were in Terezin, Walter Eisinger did everything he could to expose his boys to the ethics and morals he knew they needed.
I remember Otto Ornes told me that even though we were starving, he was asked to guard a pear tree that was heavy with ripe, perfect pears. They needed those pears for the kitchen, so Otta, 13 years old, stood in front of that pear tree all night, never closed his eyes, and never took a single pear. That's because, and I can tell you this, he, like all of us, were full with the ideas and principles Walter Eisinger fed us.
Eisinger trusted us to find our own way, and there were times he knew we would simply have to teach ourselves. After all, we were just kids. We had arguments and fights, and not everyone got along. And boys can be pretty cruel to each other, and sometimes very, very wrong. One of the most painful examples, well, stealing was always a problem, all over the ghetto and even with us. And once we found out that one of the boys in our room had stolen some food, we were furious and we demanded that we put him on trial. Eisinger didn't intervene even though he knew the circumstances. He allowed us to hold our trial, and that is when it came out that the boy had stolen the food to bring to his brother, who was dying in the infirmary. We all felt devastated and ashamed. And we learned that judging like this is no way to behave. And Eisinger knew that this was a lesson that he could not teach, but one we had to learn for ourselves.
We really did adore him. And when Eisinger got married to his wife Vera, we all saved up our one bread roll of the week, and we found a little sugar, something like a bit of cream, and we mashed it up so that it looked like a cake. And we gave it to Professor Eisinger and Vera.
Professor Eisinger accepted the boys who were assigned to him, but in one case he went to another room and recruited one boy. It was Hanusz Hachenburg, who had slept in the next bed from Leo Levy in the orphanage in Prague. And once Hanusz began writing for Vedem, we understood why.
Somewhere far away out there, childhood sweetly sleeps. Along that path among the trees, there, o'er that house, that was once my pride and joy. There, my mother gave me birth into this world, only so I could weep. In the flame of candles by my bed, I sleep, and once perhaps I'll understand that I was such a little thing, as little as this song. These 30,000 souls who sleep among the trees will wake, open an eye, and because they see so much, will sleep again.
But there was plenty of humor in each issue. And here's one article from 1943.
It happened one evening. I have an acquaintance. May God grant him eternal glory. Quite a good fellow, but with one great advantage. He once confided in me, in complete confidence, that he has an uncle in the Gestapo. Well, not every Jew has such a mishpacha. After a time, we got talking about this uncle of his. So how about your uncle?
I got it wrong. He was in the SS.
There's quite a difference, isn't there?
Well, the Gestapo is like the SS in plain clothes.
I wouldn't say that.
No, but a lot of people think so.
What did he do there?
He was in charge of their cars.
What?
You know, he was in charge of the cars, but he got paid by the SS and had a pass for the tram.
Oh, I see. He was a Jew?
What did you think he was?
A German.
Go wash your mouth out!
And we wrote about sports too.
14 players are running around the field. The match is underway. The crowd hums with excitement. He comes in on the goal. He shoots, but the goalkeeper dives after the ball and stops it. A mighty round of applause. The teams attack and defend, back and forth, and excitement in the crowd reaches a fever pitch until one team scores a goal on itself. Match is over. The spectators walk back to their quarters, but lively discussions continue. Suddenly, a question comes up. Suppose a ghetto team were to play in the Czech championships? What then?
Teaching was forbidden in Terezin. We were not supposed to be learning anything. But the way Professor Eisinger arranged it, half the boys would be outside the home working in agriculture or in carpentry, that's what I did, and the other half would be inside learning. But we always had a guard outside, so that if some SS man came up to our room, we'd know to hide our schoolbooks and pretend we were cleaning or straightening up.
I can tell you this about learning in Terezin. In 1945, I went back to school in Prague, after having been locked away in the ghetto for 4 years. And not only was I not behind the other kids in science and math, I was even ahead of the class.
Part 4. The transports to hell. The storms that swept them away. In December 1943, two transports left Terezin, taking with them 5,007 Jewish prisoners. One of those called up? Hanush Hakenberg. They arrived in Birkenau and would spend the next several months in what is known as the Czech family camp. And here, thousands of Czech Jews were kept alive inside of the gas chambers and the crematoria. They were told to write postcards back to their family and friends in Terezin, and we can only suppose the SS wanted them to lull those not yet deported into a false sense of security. Then, starting in March 1943, prisoners in the Czech family camp were sent directly to the gas. Of the 17,517 Czech Jews sent to the family camp, 1,294 of them survived. We are told that while in the Czech family camp, Hanush wrote a poem he called The Gong, about the roll call in Birkenau, about waking up and standing outside and waiting to be counted. Survivors of the family camp said that Hanus taught the poem to other children, but no one quite remembers the poem, nor do we have a photograph of him. Hanus Hachenberg was murdered in July 1943, a few days shy of his 15th birthday. Here is one of his poems about Terezin, and this is why it's important. When Terezin first started receiving prisoners at the end of 1941, the train tracks ended a few kilometers away in the village of Bohushivitsa. But with ever more Jews being sent to the ghetto, the SS demanded their Jewish prisoners build a rail line directly into Terezin. That would make it much easier for the Germans to load trains there, and also to send their victims to the east, which usually meant the gas chambers of Auschwitz-Birkenau. The first train arrived in Terezin on the 1st of June, 1943, and it was Hanus who wrote a poem about that day and about seeing that very first train.
Vedum, Terezin, 1943. The first train. It stopped at the wooden barrier, whistling woefully. It can't have wanted to go on to a place beyond the grave and destroy the colours painted on its body. Step by step, it covered the new track. Three children with large, wondering eyes watched as the wheels turned and the train drove down the street. I closed my eyes. So this is what an unbeating heart of steel, driven by steam, looks like. It gives the world no choice at all. Under your wheels, my dear, I go a little further. And worms turn green on the iron tracks. They groan because they're made of muscle, and whisper aloud their song of love. You monster, I'm alive. I too am alive. Hanus Hachenberg.
In May 1944, I had to embark on the transport from Prague to Terezin. I was shocked when I first saw Peter. It had been 2 years since I'd seen him. He was now 16, and he was no longer a child. In Terezin, he saw his role as my protector and my tutor, and I wanted to mother him because he really needed it. When I was sick and in the hospital, he came to the window and brought me some food, but I refused it and told him, "No, Peter, you must eat it." Peter also sent me a letter in English and told me I had to answer him in English. He was always, always learning and teaching.
In 1944, they were going to make the ghetto look nice for a visit by the International Red Cross, which took place in June 1944. So the first thing they did was make a massive deportation to thin out the ghetto so it would be less crowded. I think they sent over 7,000 people to the gas. And buildings were painted. They made signs for a coffee house. They issued ghetto money. It was all a horrible fiction.
I remember how we had to practice saying things when the Red Cross and the SS commandant Karl Rahm came up to us, and we were supposed to say, "Oh no, sardines again, Uncle Rahm?" As if we ever saw a sardine. And I remember Professor Eisinger sang in the choir for the Red Cross. They performed Verdi's Requiem.
After the Red Cross visit, they even made a film about how nice life was in the ghetto. I don't think it was actually ever released. And later it was joked that the title was "The Führer Presents a Town to the Jews." It was directed by the German actor Kurt Geron, who did the best job he could. And they shot the film in August and September 1944. A month later, they still sent him to the gas, along with most of those who were in it.